In Baal's holy name, stop him, Hui, Lannan panted. Don't let him get out there and sound on us. We'll lose him for a certainty. And they threw their combined weight on the line. The muscles in Hui's arms and shoulders bunched and corded like a sack of pythons, and the fish turned. They brought him up, swirling and kicking in circles under the skiff, and when his huge, whiskered head broke the surface, Lannan shouted, "Hold him!" And Hui took a turn of the line about his wrist and braced his body against the weight, the skiff heeling dangerously as Lannan snatched up the killing club and aimed a blow at the glistening black head. The surface exploded as the fish went into its death throes, and water cascaded over them, drenching them both. "Hit him!" yelled Hui. "Kill him!" And half blinded with spray, Lannan hammered at the enormous snout. Some of the blows were wild, crunching against the side of the skiff and splintering the planking. "Not the boat, you fool! Hit the fish!" shouted Hui. And at last the fish was dead, hanging in the water beside the boat. Laughing, panting and cursing, they got a heavy line through its gills and dragged it aboard, slithering in over the gunwale, slimy and black, with a belly of bright silver and bulging eyes. The whiskers above its gaping mouth still twitched and quivered as it filled the bottom of the boat, twice as long as Hui, and with a body too thick to encompass within the circle of his arms. "It's a monster," panted Hui. "Biggest I've ever seen." "You called me a fool," said Lannan. "Oh, no, Majesty, I was talking to myself," grinned Hui, and he unstoppered the amphora and poured wine for them. Lannan lifted his bowl to Hui and grinned at him over the rim. "Fly for me, bird of the sun. Roar for me, Greylion." And they drained the bowls at the same time and then laughed together like children. "It's been too long, Hui," Lannan told him. "We must do this more often. We grow old too swiftly, you and I. Our cares and duties envelop us, and we're caught in a web of our own making." A shadow passed across Lannan's eyes, and he sighed. "I've been happy these last few days, truly happy for the first time in many years." He looked up at Hui almost shyly. "You're good for me, old friend." He reached out and clasped Hui's shoulder awkwardly. "I don't know what I'd do without you. Don't ever desert me, Hui." Hui flushed, clumsy in his embarrassment. This was a mood of Lannan's to which he was unaccustomed. "Nay, Majesty," he answered huskily, "I'll be with you, always." And Lannan dropped his hand and laughed, echoing Hui's embarrassment. "Sweet Baal, but we grow sentimental as girls. Is it old age, do you think, Hui?" He raised his wine bowl over the side, making a great show of it, avoiding Hui's eyes. "There are still fish in the lake, and an hour or two of the day left. Let's use it." In the dusk, they returned to where their old shack stood, neglected and forlorn beneath the graceful ivory palms above the beach. As Hui poled the skiff around the point of the island, and they cleared the reed banks, they saw the galley lying at anchor in the bay. The royal standard of House Barker stood at her masthead, and there were lamps burning at stem and stern. The reflections of the lamps danced on the dark waters, and the sound of voices carried clearly to them. Hui stopped the skiff and leaned on the pole, and in silence they stared at the long ship. And then Lannan spoke. "The world has found us out, Hui," and his voice was tired and resigned. "Hail them for me." The lamp hanging in its chain from the roof of the stern cabin lit their faces unnaturally, highlighting cheeks and noses but leaving the eyes in shadow. Their faces were grim as they gathered about the table and listened to the messenger from the north. Although he was young an ensign in his first year of military service. Yet he had the poise of high birth, and he gave his report lucidly. He described the ripples of unrest that had lapped along the northern borders in the last few weeks. Small incidents, movements of large bodies of men seen at a distance, the smoke and fires of vast encampments. Spies reported rumors of strange occurrences, of a new god with the talons of an eagle and the claws of a lion, who would lead the tribes to a land of grass and water. Scouts had watched the sailing of many Drav vessels along the eastern reaches of the great river, an unusual coming and going, talk of secret meetings between nobody knew whom. There was a restlessness, a vast stirring and muttering, a sense of pressures and tensions building, of secret affairs afoot, the itching of storm clouds gathering and lightning brewing. Things felt, but not understood. Signs pointing into the unknown. Lannan listened quietly, frowning a little, his chin propped on his fist, and his eyes in shadow. My commander bids me tell you of his fears, that you might find all this fancy and starting at the hooting of owls. No. Lannan brushed aside the boy's plea for his report to be taken seriously. I know old Marmon better than that. He does not call out snake for an earthworm. There is more, said the boy, and he laid a leather bag upon the table. He loosed the drawstring and shook out a number of metal objects. One of the river patrols surprised a party of pagans attempting to cross in the night. They carried these, all of them. Lannan picked up one of the heavy spearheads and examined it curiously. The shape and workmanship were distinctive, and he glanced up at Hui. Well, he asked, and had his own opinions confirmed when Hui answered. Drav, no doubt of it. Carried by the pagans? Perhaps they were taken from dead Dravs, or stolen? Perhaps. Lannan nodded. He was silent a while longer, and then he looked up at the young officer. You've done well, he said, and the lad flushed with pleasure. Lannan turned next to Habakkuk Lel. Can you take us on another night run to Opet? And the admiral smiled and nodded. Lannan and Hui stood together at the stern rail and watched their island merge into the darkness as the galley drew swiftly away, leaving its wake shimmering in the light of the moon. I wonder when we'll next return here, Hui? Lannan asked softly, and Hui moved restlessly beside him but didn't answer. I feel as though I'm leaving something behind here. Something valuable, which I'll never find again, Lannan went on. Do you feel it also, Hui? Perhaps it's our youth, Lannan. Perhaps these last few days were the end of it. They were silent then, swaying to the easy motion of the galley under oars. When the island was gone, Lannan spoke again. I'm sending you to the border, Hui. Be my eyes and ears, old friend. It isn't for long, my heart, Hui apologized, although Tanith had said nothing but was fully engaged in daintily devouring a bunch of purple grapes. I'll be back before you know I've gone. Tanith pulled a face as though one of the grapes were sour, and Hui studied her face with exasperation. It was serene and lovely, and as unyielding as that of the goddess herself. Hui had come to know all of Tanith's moods, every expression or tilt of the head that heralded them. He had watched with fascination as she changed from child to full woman, from bud to ripe bloom, and he'd studied her with the patience and dedication of love. But this was one mood he had not learned how to distract. Tanith licked her long, tapered thumb and forefinger with the tip of a pink tongue, then examined her hand with interest, twisting it from side to side to catch the light. There is nobody else that the king can trust to send on this mission. It is a matter of grave importance. I'm sure, Tanith murmured, still examining her hand. Just as there was no other who could go with him to Stickfish. Now, Tanith, Hui explained reasonably, Lannan and I have been companions since our childhood. We used to go out to the islands often in the old days. It was like a pilgrimage to revisit our youth. While I sit here with a bellyful of your child alone. It was only 5 days, Hui pointed out. Only 5 days, Tanith mimicked him, with her cheeks flushed, signalling the change of her mood from ice to fire. I swear on my love of the goddess that I do not understand you. You profess your love for me, yet when Lannan Hyrcanus crooks a finger, you run to him panting like a puppy dog and roll on your back so that he may tickle your belly. Tanith, Hui began to grin. I swear you're jealous. Jealous, is it? Tanith cried, and snatched up the fruit bowl. I'll give you jealous. She hurled the bowl, and while it was still in flight, she was reaching for fresh missiles. Old Aina, nodding in the sunlight at the head of the terrace, awoke in the midst of the storm and joined Hui in flight. They found shelter behind an angle of the wall, and from there Hui cautiously reconnoitred the field and found it deserted. But he could hear Tanith weeping somewhere in the house. Where is she? Quavered Aina. In the house, answered Hui, combing fruit from his beard and mopping at wine stains on his tunic. What is she doing? Weeping, Hui said. Go to her, commanded Aina. And if she attacks me again? Hui asked nervously. Spank her, instructed Aina. And then kiss her. And she gave him a toothless but utterly knowing grin. Forgive me, Holy Father, whispered Tanith, and her tears were warm and wet upon Hui's neck. It was childish of me, I know, but every moment I spend away from you is a piece of my life wasted. Hui held her, stroking her hair, gentling her, and his chest felt congested and swollen with the strength of his love for her. He was close to tears himself as he listened to her voice. Is it not possible for me to go with you this time? She made one last appeal. Please, Holy Father, please, my love. Hui's response was regretful but firm. No, I go fast and hard, and you are already in your 3rd month. She accepted it at last. She sat up on the couch and dried her eyes. Her smile was only a little lopsided as she asked, Won't you tell me again of the arrangements you've made for the baby? She sat beside him, soft and warm, with her pale skin glowing over the faint bulge of her belly and the new heaviness of her breasts in the lamplight. Her eyes were intent as she listened, and she nodded and smiled and exclaimed as Hui told her how it would be. Of the foster mother he had selected in the cool and healthy air of the hills on the estate at Zeng. He told her how the child would grow healthy and strong, and how they would visit it there. It? Demanded Tanith playfully. Never it, my lord. Her. Him, Hui corrected, and they laughed. But beneath Tanith's laughter the sadness persisted. This was not the way it would be. She couldn't see this. She couldn't catch the happiness of it, couldn't hear the laughter of a child, nor feel the warmth of its little body against her. For a moment, the dark curtains of time opened, and, as sometimes happened, she glimpsed the future, saw dark shapes and men, and things that terrified her. She clung to Hui and listened to his voice. It gave her comfort and strength, and at last she asked softly, If I fetch your lute, will you sing for me? And he sang the poem to Tanith. But there were new verses now. Every time he sang it, there were new verses.